It is Monday, March 14th here in Washington, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Michael Lippin. Coming up, we'll ask a Russian security analyst how surprised she was to hear that Russia is pulling troops out of Syria. Our national correspondent joins us for a preview of a potentially pivotal day in the U.S. presidential election process. And I'll speak to a VOA Turkish service reporter about how Turkish people reacted to another deadly bombing in their capital city.
Everyone in the social media condemned the attack, and most of the people who were wounded or lost their lives were young people who were university or high school students. So people were like trying to reach to their loved ones via social media.
It's all ahead on International Edition. Russian President Vladimir Putin has issued an order to start pulling his forces out of Syria, where they started a campaign of airstrikes last September against militants opposed to Syria's Russian-backed leader Bashar al-Assad. U.S. officials say they haven't yet seen signs of a start to the Russian withdrawal. For some perspective, I spoke on the phone to Russian security analyst Anna Borshevskaya of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and I asked her how surprised she was by Putin's move.
Skimming the headlines, it would at first glimpse appear to be surprising, but it's not if you really read what Putin said. This is a partial withdrawal, and he was extremely unclear about exactly who's leaving. You know, he said main parts, but he also said that the Tartus Naval Facility will continue to operate, and the air base in Khmeimi will continue to operate as well. So this is a really vague statement, and in fact, Assad, Syrian state media reported, instead emphasized that Russia will remain, albeit partially.
So are we having mixed messages essentially coming out of Russia and Syria today?
You know, I think this is, you know, there's a great word in Russian. This is how I would describe it for what's happening. It's called pokazuha, which means, you know, this is a show. Putin looks, you know, he's trying to look like a great leader, a peacemaker, you know, somebody who comes in, accomplishes a stated goal, although keep in mind he said his goal was to help get rid of ISIS. You know, ISIS is not gone. So I think that's what's happening. It's pokazuha. That's how I describe it.
Well, why would Russian President Putin make this announcement now?
We're starting the Syria peace talks in Geneva today. This is the other major event that this announcement coincides with. And I think this is part of a plan that Putin wants to present Russia as a great leader, as a responsible world power, which we know Putin is not.
Well, how many of the goals that Russia wanted to achieve with this military force in Syria have, in fact, been achieved?
Putin has been able to keep Assad in power. While he kept talking about fighting ISIS, in reality, what he's been able to tangibly achieve is keep Assad in power. In fact, the last round of Syria peace talks a little over a month ago collapsed precisely because of Putin's intervention that helped stave off Assad's departure.
And how does this affect the prospects of Assad? Do you think it shows that he is strong enough to stand on his own?
It's certainly looking good for Assad right now, given all of the support that Russia has given him. You know, and again, I wouldn't interpret what's happening as Putin abandoning Assad. So if anything, I'm more concerned that Assad will remain in place and therefore a real resolution in Syria will still be far away. In fact, he made a statement to the effect that elections in Syria will continue as planned and so forth. We see reports of preparation of that in Damascus. So if anything, you know, Putin helped keep this dictator in power, and that has not changed.
And we'll see if that changes also in the upcoming peace talks. Thank you very much to Washington Institute for Near East Policy Fellow Anna Borshevskaya for speaking with VOA today.
Thank you very much.
Well, up next, we have our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee, in the studio to give us online reaction to the top story. Hi, G.
Hi, Michael.
So we've had some breaking news on this, right?
Absolutely. Reuters was one of the first to tweet about it, and it reads like this. Breaking: Putin orders start a withdrawal of main part of Russian military force in Syria from Tuesday. Michael, as you can imagine, many journalists responded to that news, and here's a couple of them. Michael Holmes with CNN International tweeted this. If Putin's troop withdrawal from Syria doesn't include aircraft, then does it mean anything? He's on Twitter at Holmes CNN. Max Fischer, who is the foreign editor at Vox.com, sent out this tweet. Obviously, we'll wait to see if Russia follows through on withdrawal from Syria, but possibly quite a vindication for diplomacy if it does. In a following tweet, he wrote, there was always indication that Putin lacked much of a military strategy and mostly hoped for narrow political gains.
Okay, so we've got some skeptical views of the Russian move there. Now, on to another subject. It is the eve of the Super Tuesday races here in the U.S. election. What are the U.S. presidential hopefuls tweeting about today?
Let's start with Marco Rubio, who's really banking on his home state of Florida to turn the tide around. He tweeted, this election is the most important in a generation. In Florida, you have an important role to play. Hashtag FL primary. But Donald Trump is still the leading Republican contender, who tweeted, we don't have a country if we don't have borders.
Any noticeable tweets from the Democratic side of the race?
Sure. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is focusing on tackling the fossil fuel industry, whereas Secretary Hillary Clinton sent out tweets about her appearance on a show where she talked about the Flint water crisis. Michael?
Well, thanks so much for those updates, G. You can follow her on Twitter at G Abby Lee, and I'm on Twitter as well at Michael_Lippin. We're going to have more on the U.S. election coming up right after this break. This is VOA.
Green Beat for a healthier planet.
Saving a tree and creating jobs at the same time. The United Nations International Fund for Agriculture Development managed to do just that in Laos, where the bong tree used in incense production was nearly wiped out. But the UN project encouraged hundreds of residents to begin growing the tree as a cash crop. And it's paid off for both the trees and the people, such as farmer Khan Nun.
The project provided us with bong tree plantations, which has been really a good activity for us and has helped me to provide sufficient food for my family.
The bong tree, says the Agriculture Fund's Stefania Dina, is one of the many success stories coming out of Laos.
This project has been particularly successful because of a very successful partnership.
The bong tree was declared facing extinction just 8 years ago, but thanks to the project, bong tree plantations now cover 2,000 hectares in Laos. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
I'm Michael Lippin, and you're listening to VOA's International Edition. For more on the U.S. election, it is the eve of Super Tuesday Part 3, the latest round of contests in which American voters will pick their preferred Republican and Democratic nominees for this November's presidential election. Our national correspondent, Jim Malone, sat down today with International Edition's Susan Yaki, who wanted to know what makes this Super Tuesday so significant.
Five big states are voting. It'll affect both party candidates. Particularly, we're looking at the Republican race right now. There's two states to watch, Ohio and Florida. If Donald Trump can sweep all five states, he would be well on his way to the Republican nomination. It looks like the biggest challenge to Trump on Tuesday will come in Ohio. That's where the home state governor, John Kasich, is running well, according to the latest public opinion polls. That's a close race. The other state, Florida, 99 Republican delegates at stake. Both Ohio and Florida are winner-take-all, so you just win the popular vote, you get all the delegates. And the polling right now shows a big advantage for Trump, double digits ahead of Marco Rubio. If Rubio does not really win in Florida on Tuesday, I'm sure there'll be a lot of calls for him to get out of the race.
What about the Democrats?
Well, we have the same five states featuring the Democratic contest. Hillary Clinton is leading, according to the polls, in most of those, particularly in Florida, also in Ohio. It looks like Illinois, which is another of the states voting on Tuesday, there's a fairly narrow gap there between Clinton and her main challenger, Bernie Sanders. So Sanders surprised at Michigan last week. He was well down in the polls. Who knows? We could see more surprises on Tuesday.
Well, meanwhile, candidates from both parties are giving a hard time to Republican frontrunner Donald Trump. And that's because of all the violence that has erupted at his rallies, even though he denies there's a lot of violence. The cameras show us people punching each other and jumping around and being taken out of the venues.
Yeah, we had a Friday night rally in Chicago that was canceled. Trump canceled it after stirring protests, at the venue. Kansas City, there were protests inside and outside the debate or the speech venue where he spoke. It's taken a really kind of serious turn over the last several days. Now, Sunday and so far on Monday, it's been a little calmer. But I think this does have, especially members of the Republican establishment, a little concerned. Trump is defiant in these rallies, is blaming outside agitators for causing the demonstrations.
He even mentioned Sanders.
Yeah, he's even mentioned Bernie Sanders. Sanders says that Trump is a pathological liar. So the elevation of debate hasn't really happened, and we are seeing these disturbances. We'll see if they continue. If they do, it's going to give the Republicans pause, even at the moment when it looks as though Trump is moving toward the nomination.
Well, you've been listening to our national correspondent, Jim Malone, in conversation with International Edition's Susan Yaki. Turkish authorities say a suicide car bomb that exploded in the capital Ankara on Sunday killed 35 people and wounded another 125. They identified one of the attackers as a woman who was born in 1992 and came from northeastern Turkey, while the other was a man. Earlier, I had a conversation with VOA Turkish service reporter Ege Saçıkara, and I asked her what information is available about who was to blame for the attack.
No organization has claimed responsibility yet, but the prime minister said they're almost certain that the PKK, Kurdistan Workers' Party, is behind the attack. This is the third attack in Ankara in the last 5 months. The first one was back in October 2015, and ISIS actually claimed responsibility. But the one that was in February this year was claimed by an organization called TAK, Kurdistan. It's like also like related to PKK, so like a splinter organization of PKK. And in this attack, the prime minister said they're almost certain that it's PKK is behind the attack.
But have they released any evidence of PKK involvement?
No.
Why are they so sure?
They said like the female attacker has joined the PKK in 2013. That's all that we know. That's all that they say. And that's all that we know. But like they have done operations, and 11 people have been detained, and they have done operations in a city called Şanlıurfa as well. And 4 were detained in there, and they were sent to Ankara for questioning.
What about the Turkish military response? We've had some airstrikes on northern Iraq today. Have they said, the Turkish government said much about the impact of those airstrikes?
Well, they said that they have hit 18 targets. I mean, Turkish military has been doing the airstrike attacks in northern Iraq in Kandil Mountain.
And this is where the PKK has bases in northern Iraq.
Yes, yes. And I mean, they said that they have done 30 shots and 18 targets were hit. And among those targets were ammunition depots, bunkers, and shelters.
Regarding the availability of social media in Turkey, I understand there were restrictions imposed on Facebook and other sites right after the bombing happened. How restricted are these social media platforms today?
Well, I mean, we cannot really say maybe restricted, but like people said they were like the social media sites were extremely slow. They had a hard time accessing their accounts. But the government is, of course, trying to, you know, remove content from Twitter most of the time. And there's also another, like, media coverage ban to these attacks. They have been media bans for other previous attacks as well. And it also includes social media. But, I mean, everyone in the social media condemned the attack. And most of the people who were wounded or lost their lives were young people who were university or high school students. So people were, like, trying to reach to their loved ones, to the young people via social media from Facebook. And of course, Facebook also activated its safety check after the blast as well.
Thank you very much to VOA Turkish service reporter Ege Saçıkara for bringing us that report on the situation in Turkey.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's science in a minute.
An international team of researchers say that they have discovered around 80 galaxies that may have existed in the young universe about 12.6 billion years ago. The team developed a list of galaxies to look for from data gathered by the Subaru telescope in Hawaii. With that information, they were able to locate these 80 early galaxies and learn more about them by analyzing imaging data gathered by the Hubble Space Telescope. About 13.6 billion years ago, that's 200 million years after the Big Bang, it's thought that cold gas clouds provided material for the first stars to be born. As these stars were being created, they formed small galaxies. The researchers were able to determine that around 1.2 billion years after the Big Bang, these small galaxies were continuously merging together and growing into larger galaxies like our own Milky Way, which contains about 200 billion stars. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition with me, Michael Lippin. Wall Street got off to a quiet start to the week, with major indexes closing Monday's trade close to break-even. I asked our financial reporter Jill Malandrino in New York what investors will focus on as the week unfolds.
Well, the market's going to certainly be on a holding pattern until we get the Federal Reserve's interest rate decision on Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern. Not only do we have that to look forward to, but the key points that you want to listen for is Janet Yellen's press conference at 2:30, because the market's not really expecting an interest rate hike right now. So traders, analysts are going to hone in and pick apart every single thing that she says at that presser. They're going to pick apart her connotation to see if we can get any clues into June's meeting. The headlines will be fast and furious coming out of there. And for the most part, traders that I speak with are just staying away right now. They're letting the algorithms and the high-frequency traders play ping pong in these small ranges here. In fact, just at 2:15 Eastern, Reuters was reporting that Russia's going to pull out of Syria because it's accomplished its objectives. The market didn't even flinch. So right now, global markets are focusing on what's going to happen on Wednesday. So I don't think, barring any big geopolitical event, that we're going to see any trend established in one direction or the other.
What kind of clues will investors be looking for from Janet Yellen?
What they'll be looking for, her thoughts on unemployment, on wage growth. Inflation is going to be the key. Growth projections are terms that you're going to want to listen to, because the Fed right now and other global central banks are very data dependent. And domestic data is relatively strong to global data. And you have to remember that central banks shouldn't be acting in concert with the market. They shouldn't be worrying about as much as market reaction, but what data is suggesting about the economy. And that's why we're seeing central banks, rather than act in coordination with each other, they're almost a little bit more competitive right now, because you have the European Central Bank that took their rates down. They're continuing to increase their quantitative easing programs by buying more assets. And we'll have to wait to see what the Bank of Japan is going to say this week. The Bank of Switzerland, the Bank of Russia is also making these decisions this week. But you're not seeing them act in much of a coordinated way, but more independently. And that's what's really interesting right now about this particular rate decision we have in March.
Thank you very much to our financial reporter in New York, Jill Malandrino, for giving us the latest on the markets.
Okay, thanks very much. I'll talk to you soon.
Now for some entertainment news. Representatives of American record producer Dr. Luke have denied that Sony Music will end its relationship with him due to allegations that he sexually assaulted pop rocker Kesha. International Edition's David Byrd and VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee talked about how Kesha's case has highlighted the issue of sexism in the music business.
She alleges that he was psychologically abusive, and then the lawsuit, she also claimed that he drugged and raped her. And this has been going on now for over a year. Recently, and this was probably in the last few weeks or so, Kesha was in court. She was asking to be released from her contract from Kemosabe Records, which is Dr. Luke's label on Sony. But the judge denied the preliminary injunction. So she was not allowed to be released from her contract. But Sony said, you can work, but just not with Dr. Luke. She has six more albums that she's required to complete for Kemosabe and also for Sony. And as a result of this, quite a few very powerful women in the industry have
including
come out.
Including people like Kelly Clarkson.
Right, have come out in support of her. Taylor Swift, I think, gave her $250,000 for her legal fees. Lady Gaga has come out publicly in support of her. Adele has come out publicly in support of her. And Kelly Clarkson, who was interviewed in Australia, said, hey, he's not a very nice guy. I had to work with him. I didn't want to, but Sony insisted. In fact, they blackmailed me. Those were her words. So there are some reports now that Sony plans to end their relationship with with Dr. Luke ahead of their ahead of the expiration date of the contract, which will be sometime next year. Now, Sony has not confirmed nor denied this, but these are the reports, and people are speculating that this is probably because this has become a PR nightmare for the label, for Sony.
And Sony doesn't like bad PR. I mean, it's like, we want everything to stay stable. We want everybody to be happy, and mm-hmm. let's all get along. Because
right.
in the end, Sony is not in business to make artists happy, even though making the artist happy is important.
Yeah.
Sony is in business to sell CDs or downloads or vinyl records or whatever format you choose to consume their music on. And anything that interrupts that process, it's just like the Takata airbag thing with Honda.
Mm.
Honda had to call back a whole bunch of cars because there was something wrong with the cars, and they don't want their brand being associated with something bad. Am I right in that?
You're absolutely right, and that's exactly what's happened. I mean, this is a huge story, not only in the pop music world, but folks who are inside the music industry are watching this very closely, because this is one of the first times where we've actually seen the inner workings of the industry. There are other artists who have come out, not against Dr. Luke, but other female artists who have come out to say, you know, this is kind of par for the course. And so Kesha has become sort of a shero for many of the women in the industry. Now, I think it's very important, however, to say that Dr. Luke denies all of the allegations. And Sony, a representative for Sony, came out to say, we have no evidence that what Kesha is alleging is actually true. So right now it really is he said, she said.
Okay, well, that's where we'll have to leave it for right now. If you have any comments on this, you can send Shauna a tweet. She's at VOA Lady DJ. You can also hit her up at VOA underscore music. And you can look for her show, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
That's it for International Edition on The Voice of America. Today's show was brought to you by director Tracy Carter and engineer Jim Harmon. I'm Michael Lippin in Washington. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow with another International Edition featuring coverage of Super Tuesday voting here in the U.S. Hope you can join us then.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Respect for human rights plays a critical role in countering violent extremism, said U.S. Undersecretary for Civilian Security, Democracy, and Human Rights, Sarah Sewell. When corruption goes unaddressed, citizens may conclude that government exists not to serve but to exploit. Secretary of State John Kerry has called corruption a radicalizer because it destroys faith in legitimate authority. In such a vacuum, violent extremists that portray themselves as pious and untainted can offer a seemingly seductive alternative. Additionally, when there are no jobs and prospects for a better future, when people struggle to feed and house their families, feelings of exclusion, hopelessness, and indignity can be openings for violent extremists peddling false promises of a better deal. And finally, when governments respond to terrorist propaganda by restricting freedoms of speech, assembly, and religion, they risk silencing the voices most needed to fight violence and hatred. Clamping down on political opposition under the guise of fighting terrorism has become all too common, said Undersecretary Sewell. Yet it can backfire spectacularly by radicalizing the nonviolent individual and confirming violence as the only route to political change. Time and again, nations around the world, including ours, relearn the harsh lessons of framing security as a zero-sum trade-off with fundamental human freedoms, said Undersecretary Sewell. A comprehensive approach to countering violent extremism recognizes this as a false dichotomy and highlights the importance of good governance and human rights protections in preventing the next generation of violent extremism. Countering violent extremism emphasizes preventive action and advances collective security while championing universal values.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.